What is up, everybody? This is Dr. Joe Camerato with the Across the Continuum podcast. And I wanted to come on here and just kind of chat through, I guess, the principles and ideas that I kind of compare any sort of passive modality against when it comes to considering the efficacy or effectiveness of this passive modality when we use it with patients. And so over the last, 10 years, dry needling has become super, super popular, right? We have this intervention that is invasive but isn't. And so whenever there's like a chance for physical therapists to kind of broaden their scope outside of what it might need to be, they definitely jump at that. So we have this cool new sexy thing that not only is invasive, which kind of ups our prestige, but also is quote unquote very direct at what it is that the patient is complaining about. And so we have this thing that over the past 10 years has become very popular, so much so to the point that whenever anybody kind of asks in Facebook groups or, you know, on Instagram or wherever, what continuing education course that they should take, usually dry needling is 90% of those comments. And, you know, I was posting, I think yesterday, maybe a few days ago, about the kind of inadequate percentage, really, or majority of continuing education courses that actually follow clinical practice guidelines. I think it's 47% do follow clinical practice guidelines, and 53% of continuing education courses in the country teach something or go over something that is not supported or not recommended by clinical practice guidelines that are usually, you know, put out by governing bodies or systematic reviews, meta-analyses, things like that. And full disclosure, I am certified in dry needling. I got it back when I worked for the Air Force, 7 years ago. And then again, when I worked for the Air Force in another spot about 6 years ago. And so I'm level one and level two certified. I actually don't even know if they have levels anymore. But level one being doing all the bigger, kind of easier to get to muscles and things. And then level two being, the feet, the hands, the face, stuff like that, which is as fun as it sounds to go through that course and get needles stuck in your jaw and temporalis muscles against your skull. But, I'm very forthcoming with my bias, which is that exercise should be the primary thing that we are using to rehabilitate people, considering that over 80% of the population is not active enough to be considered healthy. And when they're not active enough to be considered doing health-promoting things, they are actively accumulating comorbidities, taking lives off, years off the end of their life. And it's really like concerning, considering how much dry needling has kind of taken over, really. Now, there's about 6 points that kind of just shape the framework of how I think about passive modalities at large. And so we can substitute dry needling with something like manual therapy or manipulations or, cupping or K-taping, things like that. And so this is not exclusively for dry needling, but it's been a long road of looking into, quote unquote, doing my own research, looking into things, taking podcasts, continuing education courses, really looking at stuff to build this framework that I wanted to communicate here today, because this framework is what I use to juxtapose implementations of new passive modalities into clinical practice. Not that I do clinical practice anymore, but I teach and mentor a lot of clinicians, and the things that we consider passive modalities are, embedded in the physical therapy career field, in the chiropractic's career field, and surely soon to be the athletic training career field at some point. Not a physical therapist can have anything to do with that, holding other people down. But There's about 6 points, and I'm going to try and flesh out some of these points into sub points. And again, just like how I kind of frame things, because at the stage that I'm at right now, having been a physical therapist for about 7 years, and again, very clearly biased towards exercise, strength training in particular, it's very hard for me to sway myself towards things that are not that. And so I'm very clear, very, very open about my bias. And I'm also very clear that the bias is there for a good reason, right? The things that I recommend are good for you. And we're going to get into a little bit here, but I'm very aware that the things that I recommend are also not great for pain management or symptom modification, or at least not as good as or better than most of the other things that I'm going to talk about here. And, you know, there's an argument to be made that the things I'm going to talk about here are actually better at symptom modification than what I'm pushing, which is exercise. But I think the broken record that I'm going to sound like here is that there's no secondary benefits to any of the past modalities that are health promoting in any way. And I actually think that they cause harm. So the first bullet that I want to get into here is our ability to accurately palpate structures in general. So if we look at something like the PSIS or the ASIS, the posterior superior iliac spine and the anterior superior iliac spine, things like that, like very like day one physical therapy school structures, the ability for us to accurately palpate those is actually pretty poor. And so things that are prominent like this that we're needing to find, at least in the category of dry needles, like the literally a pinhead area, is probably not super reliable. And in an invasive treatment in which we are sticking needles into areas that have structures like nerves, that have structures like blood vessels, that have structures like lungs, little things like those, you would hope that our ability to palpate those structures and really find where we're at on the body would be good. Now, again, if we look at research about inter and intra-related reliability, which is like between two people and then between two different exposures of the same person to palpation, they're really not great. And so we have this very first concern. And again, whether this is dry needling, manual therapy, manipulations, you know, anything here, just our ability to kind of be specific sucks. Our ability to find specific things, and especially like, let's say for a dry needling specifically, like a muscle knot, right? The idea is there's some sort of dysfunctional motor junction or motor endpoint or whatever. The idea that we could find that, which is, I think, like way smaller than a pinhead, and accurately and specifically intervene on that is kind of nuts, right? And we can do this, and we can be relatively accurate if we have input from the person. And so I'll definitely say that with the input from the person that you know, we can probably find what we're looking for. But again, it's like if we shut that off, or we shut off the subjective input from the person, or we don't really get anything from them, we find that it's pretty hard for us to find areas or locate places. So let's say that you have the magic fingers, as somebody like Mark Cargill would say. You've upgraded to the level of, you know, Jedi Master, and you can find this quote-unquote muscle knot. We come into the second problem here, number two, which is like simply the presence of a knot, if they even exist, does not mean that there are going to be symptoms coming from that area. And so let's say we're in the upper trap or the calf, which is, you know, we have pretty good idea of being able to find quote unquote trigger points in those areas. We can have knots that don't produce symptoms. or asymptomatic structures, or asymptomatic abnormalities, as we might say. And so the question being, the same question that really the billion-dollar question here, which is like, what sort of connection, what sort of contribution do the physical structures or the anatomic structures of our body, what sort of relationship, what sort of contribution do they make to symptomatic presentations? Now, I'm not going to stand here and say, oh, it's all in your head, and you know, we're really just these beings that are predicting reality and there's nothing's real and it's all just whatever. But it kind of brings us back to this like biomedical model of thinking, right? And I've talked about this in our course where we're doing quote unquote body work, and it, we do all this good work and we have these nice narratives that say, oh, you're robust and you're resilient and your body's not fragile and you can do things. And then we break out needles and say, but you know, we're just going to stick this needle in this one specific thing so that you don't have pain anymore and it functions correctly. There's no more dysfunction in that area. And the question being, like, do they actually contribute to what's called myofascial pain syndrome, which is like musculoskeletal pain? Now, if you read some of the work by John Clintner, he calls this into question, saying that, you know, we can look at areas that have trigger points and no symptoms, and we can have, you know, areas that have symptoms with no trigger points in them. And so what really are we doing when it comes to blaming trigger points, if they even exist, on myofascial or blaming myofascial pain syndrome or pain presentations on trigger points? Now, of course, there are sensitive areas that we can decide to stick a needle into, but you go up to anybody, you do this in high school as a guy, you go up to anybody and squeeze their upper traps, they're going to be in a lot of pain. Now, does that mean that we, as soon as we do play that joke on them, we send them to the physical therapist to get dry needled? No, of course not. You know, there are areas that just don't feel good to palpate. You get anybody on your table, you palpate their soleus, their gastroc, their upper trap, their glute med. Like, these are all areas that are just inherently sensitive. You get the anterior shoulder. You stick a thumb towards somebody's biceps tendon, they're going to recoil. And so we have these areas that are painful, and you get physical therapists who will do their objective examination and start poking on people, and there's sensitivity in these areas that I just listed, and they're like, oh, maybe that area is dysfunctional. Not really attributing the fact that it might just be sensitive because you're jamming your body parts into it. So that's number two, is, you know, the structure, and what does that play in symptom presentation, and why can we have the presence of knots, quote unquote, trigger points, without any sort of symptom present? Why can we have the presence of sensitive tissues without any sort of myofascial pain syndrome going on? And if we do have myofascial pain syndrome, but we also have knots that exist, maybe, that aren't causing pain, then how do we use that information for making decision-making going forward? All right, so let's say you have the ability to palpate accurately and that knots do contribute or cause myofascial pain syndrome. The next kind of hurdle that we need to get over is sham needling or fake needling, in which they take a toothpick and they blind or lie to the participant and say, this is a dry needle, and they poke their skin in the same ritual that they might use a dry needle. You know, they put the toothpick in a plastic sleeve and then they wipe the area down so that we can try and replicate as closely as possible actually using dry needle. And then they perform, quote unquote, that dry needling with a toothpick. And we see similar outcomes between a toothpick and a needle. And we see this, you know, across multiple manual therapies. A couple things, right? The difficulty with being able to sham manual therapy, which kind of leads to another problem of, oh, well, manual therapy did better than the sham. Okay, well, how do you sham cupping, right? If they feel different, how do you sham tape? Well, you just use duct tape, and, you know, we know that it doesn't really matter the type of tape that you use, just that there's tape on that person, they're going to feel better. How do you sham a manipulation? Well, you just take them to end range without actually doing the high velocity, low amplitude thrust. People get better the same, whether there's a cavitation or not. How do you sham something like massage? Well, you know, it's difficult. But when we sham needling, we see that there's similar outcomes between symptom resolution and how people are reporting subjectively. And so let's say that you're able to palpate accurately these presence of knots that are contributing myofascia pain syndrome, and we're going to do dry needling. Cool. Well, I mean, we know that we can just stick anything sharp in there and they'll feel better. So that's number three. I think number four has to do with contextual effects, with kind of, which kind of goes along with the previous one. And that is kind of what we would call like placebo effects, right? We don't want to use, I mean, we can use placebo effects, you know, forward thinking people say contextual effects or meaning effects. Contextual effects basically being like what I would call the show or the situation or context with which the intervention is being delivered, right? So I've definitely talked about contextual effects before in one of my previous presentations called The Science of Feeling Better, in which we evaluate the term "it works" and what that means. But the context being the dress of the provider, whether they're in casual clothes or in a lab coat, the gender and race of the provider, the location of the office, the temperature of the office, the environment that they're being treated in, the previous exposures or experiences that the patient and the provider have had with the intervention, the Pygmalion effect and the Gollum effect, basically self-fulfilling prophecies. And so the show surrounding the intervention at hand. And the passive modalities just so happen to have a pretty great show, right? It's something that happens immediately. There's skin and tissue being sucked up into a cup. Possibility that there's blood coming out if you're doing wet cupping. And specifically with dry needling, the show is a step up from the other passive modalities simply because it is invasive. It kind of like breaches, no pun intended, it kind of breaches into this new category, because we know that there are plenty of surgeries that are the ultimate show that are no better than sham surgeries. And so it calls into question the show itself, right? We have this needling event that's invasive, and it's also right where the patient is subjectively saying they're having trouble, right? I used to think of pain as this little like black pellet or this black ball that was lodged in your skin back when I was a kid. No, not while I was a physical therapist, but that you could cut it out and you'd be fine and that pain will be gone. It's a proverbial splinter in somebody's finger, and once you pull that splinter out, they're going to feel better. And so the invasive show is going right where they want it to and right where they're asking for it, because you can't find it without them telling you where it is. But it kind of lends itself to a really great contextual effect. And then we have a lot of studies comparing like electric needling versus regular needling. And the electric needling, the percutaneous needling, is better than the transcutaneous needling, I think is what they call it. Or the percutaneous electrical stimulation is better than the transcutaneous electrical stimulation, meaning that if we stick a needle in and then electrocute it, that's better than just electrocuting the skin on its own. That's better than just needling, and that's better than just electricity. And it's like, duh. I mean, there's more show. You're hooking somebody up to jumper cables. Well, all the while, if you've gotten to the point where you're hooking them up to jumper cables, you are very bought in, which is the Pygmalion effect, meaning that you're selling this intervention like bananas. And so you're doing a very good job of selling it, managing their expectations. And then we look at A versus A plus B research, where we have A, which is dry needling, versus A plus B, which is dry needling plus electrical stimulation. And usually the A plus B has a greater effect than the A intervention. And the idea is simply because they're getting more stuff. But what a lot of the A plus B versus A studies fail to do is have a control group, meaning that there's not anybody that's getting nothing. And so you can't see how they react to the lack of anything. And so we're lacking a control group, which means that we're basically saying, like, this fairy dust is worse than this fairy dust plus a tiara or something like that. So anyway, that's number four, that contextual effects have a pretty large role. And within those contextual effects are our expectations and beliefs from both parties, both the clinician and the patient. So let's say you can palpate accurately and that trigger points do exist and that they contribute to symptoms and that needling isn't, or needling is better than a sham and that the context doesn't matter. Well, then we have to kind of question, like, how are we communicating what's going on to the person, right? There's a big group of people who are of the idea that, oh, as long as the narrative, as long as that's good, it doesn't matter. As long as you're explaining it well to this person, then you should be able to educate them to the point that they don't really believe in the bad stuff that could come of it, or that they, you know, there's no way that they, my narrative was good. I explained that this, they were not actually releasing the muscle, that it's not breaking up the trigger point. It's simply a placebo effect. And I educated them around that. It's just, you know, you're going to feel better. We don't really know why, but we just know that you're going to feel better. Well, I mean, I think there's a couple problems, and point six is, we're going to get to that one. But the first one is, like, the question I always ask is, are they going to remember your speech? Now, if anybody's treated a patient, give them any sort of education or a home exercise program or told them anything at length, which a lot of physical therapists who start to learn stuff do, they go and they come back a few weeks later, or maybe the next week or whatever, and they're saying the same stuff that they're saying before you educated them. Or they were doing calf raises when you asked them to do glute bridges. And so, I mean, I think that this point is a little bit weaker than the other ones, where, you know, it sounds like I'm assuming that patients are unable to retain information. And that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that I think people put too much trust into their education and that it's going to kind of, a one-off is going to inoculate the patient from the logical and common sense thinking that they're likely to make with this intervention that has so much nuance around it. And what I mean by that is that if they don't remember your speech and if they don't remember the education, then the thing that they're going to remember is that he stuck a needle right where it hurts. It twitched, maybe, adding to the show. And I feel better. And so it must have been something in there that he released or loosened up or what have you. And again, you know, it's, I know that those of you listening to this who have educated or given patients stuff know that they come back with not what you gave them or not thinking the way that you hoped they would after your education or what have you. And so even if the narrative is good, we have to call into question, is that going to land? If we're talking for more than 10 seconds about something, are they going to remember the whole extent of it? Or are they going to remember the general idea of how they felt or the general idea of what happened? And then point number six is when clinicians acknowledge that it's placebo or that it's all contextual, all placebo, quote unquote, and they do it anyway, right? And this one's kind of always, I guess, ruffled me up a little bit more than the other ones, right? I think that if you genuinely believe the things that I've laid out here, the opposites, right, that you can palpate things, that you can blame myofascial pain syndrome on trigger points, that you can be very efficacious, or that the needling is efficacious, then it's totally reasonable for you to give this intervention. But to recognize all these things and still go forward with the intervention, knowing that there's nothing more to it than the placebo effect, is kind of odd, in my opinion. Now, I'm first to say that everything has a placebo effect. Everything has a contextual effect. We can't do exercise and have the patient get better immediately and blame that totally on the exercise or totally on the strength or what have you, whatever you want to attribute. And so I know that everything has a contextual effect. Everything exists in a context. But I don't understand when we're just like, yeah, it's a placebo, it works, why do we question it? And I think that there's a few different subpoints that I want to make here. Number one being, where does it end? Right? Where do we draw the line when it comes to leaning 100% on a contextual effect or a meaning response or a placebo effect? If somebody believes that you are going to hit them over the head with a shoe and that is going to make them better, and they ask for that, is that outside the realm of possibility for us to provide as an intervention? Oh, but Joe, that's a straw man. You're just building this easy target to knock down. I understand that. But if you scour the internet for a day in the rehab world, you'll see all sorts of crazy stuff that get pretty close to what I'm talking about. You see people hung from chains by their feet. You see people beating patients over the heads or over the knees with hammers. You'll see people doing dry needling through their abdomen to get to their anterior spine. Sounds pretty cool. You'll see recommendations for nutrition that is way outside of what would be a regular recommendation. And so the question stands at, where does it end? We crack the leeches back out. Do we get the diathermy machine running? I actually don't know any about the research on diathermy. I'm throwing it under the bus there. I'm sorry, diathermy folks. I don't know about that one. But where does it end? Where do we draw the line? I mean, we have people recommending, and obviously if you listen to the last podcast, you know I'm hot about this, recommending going and getting a plunger and using it on their patients. Which leads us into subpoint number two, which is the epistemic responsibility that I feel like I'm talking about all the time. And that is understanding the origin of your claims, of your ideas, of your theories, of your opinions, and doing your very best to make sure that those origins are good sources of information. Now, I can't get behind the idea that there is an epistemic responsibility, or that there is a hard drive for epistemology when it comes to clinicians who are saying, I know it's a placebo and I'm going to use it anyway. Like, what I almost want to call into question, like, the integrity of the practitioner at this point. And I'm not trying to, like, maybe I am being, you know, provoking, but if you know it's not real and you know that there's no secondary effect, it's almost like you're tricking the patient. Now, I hear people saying, well, what do you want me to do? Nothing's getting them better. Well, I'm just supposed to tell them tough shit? It's like, okay, let's pull on that thread for a second. Let's say nothing's getting the better. And so we need to turn to something like something that is only a placebo effect. I don't understand how that's better. Because what we're doing, and actually surgery is a pretty good example. And I can't remember the name of the Australian surgeon thing who wrote the book Surgery, the Ultimate Placebo. But he makes a point of like, okay, we know that something like Achilles tendon rupture, they have similar outcomes, right? And again, Cody wrote about this. There are pros and cons to each one, but let's just say that's the one. We know that it's a sham surgery and they're going to get better, but it's not going to do the thing that, you know, the efficacy is not there. Is that any better to expose them to those false narratives, the inherent risk of harm, especially with something like dry needling, which is, you know, an invasive procedure? Yes, it's clean and you know, the infection rates are low, but they're non-zero. Is jeopardizing their health or exposing them to more medicine better than being like, I'm sorry, we just can't do anything productive right now? I don't know. I would err on the side of no. I would kind of just say, I know that what we did didn't work and you're free to take your money somewhere else, but I just can't realistically provide these things. You know, I don't know. I think that that's more of a game time decision or on the ground conversation, so to speak. But subpoint number three of, I know it's just a placebo, but it works, is what's the opportunity cost of the time spent doing this thing that you know is just a placebo? Oh, dry needling only takes a minute. Okay, that's fine, but it's still like some people have appointments just for dry needling. And I will contend, or I don't even know if contend's the right word, I will say that this stuff does not take a very long time. It can be a very small part of the intervention, but it's still like, if it's not doing anything, the opportunity cost being, we can just spend that time exercising or training or educating them or what have you, instead of, if you're subscribed to the idea that it's just a placebo and I'm going to do it anyway because their outcomes are going to improve or their symptoms are going to get better, I'm just going to do it anyway because. So there's an opportunity cost there. And then, I mean, I'm just going to add this one on, the subpoint number four is like, it works. Right now I have an entire 30-minute presentation called The Science of Feeling Better that I put on for Barbell Rehab and Mike Mash a few years ago. But just the claim that it works, I mean, by whose definition? The patients. And again, I sound like a broken record parrot. If anything works, if we're under the impression that all we want to do is do something that quote unquote works, and the definition of it works being symptom modification, we know that anything can do that. And so why not omit that opportunity cost and add in things that we know are going to benefit the person and their health as a whole, and not expose them to more risk? Anyway, that's my framework. Can we palpate things accurately? Does the presence of knots actually matter or actually exist? Is needling better than sham? Where does the show come into play? How are we communicating? Are they remember that communication accurately? And if you know it's a placebo, then what the hell, right? But that's the framework that I use when I consider adopting things like passive modalities or really like any newfangled stuff, right? We know that physical therapy is full of craziness. And you may define craziness different than I do, and I'm well aware of my stance as being on one end of the spectrum. But I think that this is a good, of course I think it. personally, I think this is great. I think this is a good way to reflect. Are we being accurate? Does this presentation of this symptom of this structural abnormality, if we can even call it an abnormality, matter? Is this better than sham? What are the contextual effects? Is the show the real driver here? And then what does this communicate? Yeah. That's all I got. I would love to actually get some pushback on this, because triangulating is something that I know there's a huge following. There's a lot of evidence. I have not read all the evidence, obviously. That would be nuts. I would have no time for anything else. Please hit me up on Instagram or on Facebook or an email or whatever. I would love to hear counterpoints. Yeah, have a great day.